Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And good evening to you, and welcome to KZSC Santa Cruz, UCSC. I'm your host, John Sandage. It is the Talk About Show, and our first guest tonight will be Dr. Dawn Motyka, and she'll be taking some phone calls, and we'll be with her till 8 o'clock tonight. So think up some medical things you will want to talk about, and we have done the same, so stick around, and we'll get started with that in just a few minutes. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KZSE staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee by calling 831-459-4726 or emailing prc@kzse.org. I'm pleased to welcome back Dr. Dawn Motyka.
Well, I'm glad to be back.
And I got to start this out. Last month when you were here, I had taken this fall and stepped into a hole and tweaked my leg pretty bad. And after the show, she says to me, "What's wrong? You're limping." And I said, "Yeah." And I told her the story about falling into the hole, and it was hurting pretty bad. And so she said, "Well, how do you feel about acupuncture?" And I had had acupuncture before, and I watched my father have acupuncture, and it has worked. And I thought, well, okay. And she says, well, come on down. So we go down to her car in the parking lot, and she does acupuncture on me. Now, this sounds sort of strange, but we will explain a little more of this in a moment. But she put a needle with a little injection thing that put a needle in two of my toes. And then she put a pin in my side of my head, up by my temple someplace. And she said, now you have to leave these on for 20 minutes and then you can take them off. And it's about 20 minutes to my house. And about halfway there, it stopped hurting. I said, wait a minute, there's no pain here anymore. And when I got home, it was totally gone. I was walking as normal as I had when I got up in the morning. And I had my partner, Betty, pop those needles out and pull the one out. And that's been a month ago. And I've never had another problem. But it's been more than a month ago. It's been 6 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I've never had a problem with it since. Now, to me, that verges on magic. And as I asked her early, and I want you to hear the answer to this question, how do they know? How do they know which toe, where to put it, and then why would it combine with one in your forehead? That just baffles me. And so Dawn has a good answer, and here it is.
Well, it's trial and error with taking notes for 5,000 years. And if you think about it, we always are taught that, well, that's the placebo-controlled double-blind study and nothing else works, and we've really drunk the Kool-Aid on that in conventional medicine. But there's other ways to figure stuff out, and many primitive cultures, for example, figured out elaborate astronomy just by watching the sky and taking notes effectively. Oh, wait, that came around. Or, oh, look, here's that eclipse coming along. And they built these devices. I mean, Stonehenge is effectively a calculator for predicting eclipses and the equinoxes and various other things. And I don't know a lot about Stonehenge, so please, if you'd like to talk about Stonehenge, I guess you can call in and tell me. But anyway, I shouldn't say that, huh?
Yeah, okay. No, let's keep on acupuncture because okay. They will, you know.
All right, so back to the acupuncture. The most impressive thing I can say is that through this process of trial and error and taking notes, they've been able to identify these energy pathways, which kind of crawl between the muscle bellies and the ligaments and the tendons, and they're areas of least resistance. And the concept that I like best for understanding this is that what's in there, in the space between the things, is salt water. And it's actually kind of a salt water and protein gel, like, you know, when you open a canned ham and there's that goo. And it's really tasty, and that's basically collagen.
Yeah.
But so you've got protein and you've got salt, and salt is a polar material. It carries a charge. It will, it, and it will propagate a signal. And so effectively, what there's this thing called qi, which is a type of energy that we do not have a qiometer to measure. So to science, it doesn't exist. But you can do all kinds of indirect things to demonstrate that these channels exist. For example, if you take a radio tracer, like something along the lines of one of the dyes that they might use in nuclear medicine to image your pancreas or image heart ischemia, you can inject that into any point that is not an acupuncture point, and it'll spread out through the tissues in a circle, just as if you dropped a piece of ink onto a paper towel. It's going to spread out in a circle. If you put that same tracer into an acupuncture point, let's say on the gallbladder meridian, which I believe is one of the meridians I treated on you. So let's suppose I put it at the outside of your ankle and right in front of the big bone. If I do that, you can track the radioactivity moving along the meridian of the gallbladder, and it'll go back, it'll go up your leg and zigzag around your back. And the tools, besides, you know, trial and error that the Chinese had, were basically a very, very elaborate way of diagnosing things with the pulses. So I think you, over time, they were able to map these meridians, and they had a very elaborate structure of associations and pathways and their resonance frequencies, essentially. And anybody who's ever looked at, learned Fourier analysis knows that you can break down a complex waveform into several different waves that have a regular beat, and they add up and subtract with each other to give you this unique signature, such as the sound of my voice, which we could reduce if we put it through an oscilloscope to a bunch of different sine waves that would reflect the timbre of my voice. And that's something that acupuncture uses, I believe, to send signals through the body that can affect the nervous system, as in your pain. But more, what we did for you with your injury was we did an anti-inflammatory treatment. So I kind of call it Super Motrin. And I do this anytime someone's post-op. So if I have a patient who goes in for a knee replacement, a hip replacement, anything on the extremities, it works particularly well for. And I'll go into the post-op suite at the hospital or the surgery center, and I'll put a couple of needles in their toes. And I worked very hard, by the way, to get permission. So ironic, because here you have this facility where people are being cut open, and, you know, it's like, and you're worried about me putting a tiny little, not even hollow needle that's sterile into their, you know, the edge of their toenail. It's like, really? But seriously, and I'm their doctor. I'm their attending physician. I mean, I couldn't probably do it for someone who I wasn't their physician. I could technically at this hospital, but, yeah, you know, I can't do it down at Chomp, for example.
Down at where?
Community Hospital, Monterey Peninsula.
Oh, I see.
Or for that matter, I can't do it in Watsonville because I don't have privileges for acupuncture.
And is that just because of a long living prejudice against acupuncture?
It's very, very, very threatening to the medical establishment to acknowledge that there's another powerful methodology, or because that what else is out there. And this is turf battle, man, and this is big business.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know.
You mean you don't get to sell me some pills?
Right. And don't forget, medical education has largely been funded and structured since the 1920s by the pharmaceutical industry. And they've applied business-type strategies to making it an extremely dominant part of medicine. And, you know, back in the 1920s, there was chiropractors, there were all sorts of naturopaths, there were a bunch of other branches of medicine that had their shingles hung out and were, you know, as powerful or almost as powerful as allopathic medicine. And that's now really shifted. And part of that is a really concerted effort on the part of the pharmaceutical industry to teach doctors that the only valid form of science is the placebo-controlled double-blind trial, which you can't do a sugar pill for acupuncture. If I come within 3 feet of you, I'm affecting your energy field. This, and that, by the way, I can prove scientifically.
Yeah.
But that
does that have anything to do with your aura?
Well, there are people who say they see auras.
Yes.
And if you probably when you're seeing auras, you're seeing the energy field. And how you see that with what organ in their in your brain, I would love to take some. I would love to take a bunch of people who see auras and study that. I'd like to get maybe 5 people who see auras, maybe 10, and bring a whole bunch of people in into a locked and silent room, one by one, to each individual. What color is that aura? You know, draw it for me. And then, you know, bring the next subject in and just pick random people, you know, medical students, research, the research lab rat of choice in our field. And then compare the aura readings. How well do they correlate? We do this occasionally with things like x-rays and mammograms, and we'll get, you know, half a dozen radiologists in to read the same film. And, you know, the best case scenarios are about 90%, which means there's 10% disagreement about what they're seeing. And that's in a controlled situation. And then sometimes the variation's quite a bit greater. And but if you could get, you know, even 75% correlation on what color is the aura between a 5 people who claim to be able to see auras, I'd consider that a publishable study. I could probably put that out there and someone would take it if I did the methods properly. And maybe that could open some minds.
Well, you certainly kept mine open. I mean, I had a belief in it, but it was so, like, instantaneous. I mean, it was faster than the Motrin, that's for sure. And I'm not a guy who takes pain pills or any of those. I don't have many pains. And so when that happened, it hurt, but it was okay. But it went away just boom.
The fresher it is, the easier it is to do this, by the way. Because that's why I think it's the inflammatory cascade that I'm affecting. So let me talk about that for a second.
Sure, but let me do this first. Sure. 459-4036. If you want to call in with questions, we'd love to have your questions also.
So genetics, or what's going on when you hurt yourself, is that a series of chemical signals are released from your injured tissues. And these chemical signals go to the cells of, let's say, the muscle that you just pulled, and they turn on something called prostaglandin. So molecular thing that sits on the surface of the cell that recognizes the signal and heads on down to the nucleus of the cell, goes inside the nucleus, sits on some DNA, and opens the DNA like a zipper, unzipping it, and starts replicating or triggers the replication of the messenger RNA off that piece of DNA. That goes straight to the little protein factory called the ribosome, and it starts spitting out prostaglandins. And this is called upregulation, and this upregulation happens in a matter of minutes, and it persists, and it's a feedback loop. So you get amplification of this prostaglandin cascade that goes on for several days, and these prostaglandins are what make you hurt, and they create inflammation. They send more blood to the area so that you can start healing it. They call the white cells over to start chewing up the debris. So it's a very adaptive response, but it has a tendency to overshoot. It's a little overeager. So what we'd love to be able to do is rein in that response so that it was just enough. The Goldilocks principle, right? We want it just right. And with an early injury, it's amazing what you can do. So I never go anywhere without acupuncture needles. I have them in my little cosmetic bag. I have a little red bag in my car, which you saw.
Exactly.
And if I hurt myself, I will immediately, you know, take off my shoe or put my needles in my finger and put my needles in my face or my underarm area, whatever's the appropriate
You can
input.
Treat yourself?
Oh, yeah. It's not hard to stick in, you know.
I know. It was easy.
You can get...
I
can get to any area I need to with this treatment. There are certain treatments that I can't really do a good low back pain treatment if it's more of a chronic pain. I can't reach, you know.
Yeah.
My wrists don't turn that way. But what I was saying is... never go anywhere. I mean, when I fly... I always get searched because I take my little acupuncture thing with me on the airplane. Because I want to be trapped on a desert island awaiting rescue without my needles and my little stimulator. It is that powerful. I mean, I could stitch up a wound with that thing. I can surround it with needles. I can turn it on, put the frequency correctly, and I could stitch somebody up with no anesthesia. And they will either not feel it or barely feel it, depending on whether they're looking at it and going, ah,
yeah,
or whether we can distract them. If we can distract them, they won't feel it.
Well, I think I'm not alone now in my feeling that this is sort of magic. You know, I mean, it's a complete understanding of the system.
It's technology.
Yeah.
It's a technology, but it's an ancient technology, and it doesn't rely on – it relies on a very simple machine. That's it.
Now, you have just recently gone into doing this in the last couple of years now, I guess.
Isn't it? Oh, no.
I know you've done it, but you've opened your own practice.
Right. I'm a gradualist. So I started doing acupuncture and renting an office in about 2000. And I would just rent one day a week because I didn't have that many patients. I found I could not do acupuncture in my regular medical office. I tried it initially because I was a part owner and I didn't have to pay rent. But it made me sick, physically sick.
How so?
Because I lost my shielding. So basically, when you're doing energy medicine, you have to actually interact. When I put that needle in, my energy field and your energy field are connected. And I found that if I was in a setting where there was a lot of other pain or discomfort going on in the environment, like a medical office with three doctors working, that it was sort of soaking into me. It was an odd phenomenon. And I would be just so tired and wiped out compared to if I did it in another place, like at home. So I experimented. I rented this chiropractor space in Scotts Valley, and I could do all the acupuncture I wanted, and it didn't make me sick. And it was
interesting.
How cool is that?
Have you talked to other practitioners about that?
I have talked to people who do acupuncture at Kaiser and at the VA. And they both describe describe getting really tired from it. And I basically made the suggestion, why don't you try doing it outside and see if you feel as tired? Because doctors and nurses for the most part who are doing acupuncture, who are the people who would have that conflict, are people who don't. Goodness gracious. You have to be careful what you say to them or you lose all credibility and they decide you're a flake and that's it. And once people decide you're a flake, they stop hearing you. And as you might have noticed, I have a lot to say.
Yes, you do. But you have a great way of explaining it where it's much easier to understand. But I remember my father doing this sometime back in maybe the mid-80s, and he had his whole life had a twitch in his eye. And somebody got him to go for acupuncture, and he left that day, and it never reappeared. And so is this a cure-all?
I wouldn't use the word cure-all. Like, for example, I wouldn't attempt to treat a severe infectious disease like an acute appendicitis or a ruptured diverticula or a heart valve infection. I wouldn't try to treat that. First of all, I would consider that to be malpractice on my own part because I have other solutions for those things that I believe work better. I think it's best to think of it as complementary. There's plenty of people who can't tolerate drugs for their various conditions who can tolerate acupuncture. So that's number one. Number two, there's plenty of stuff that we don't have good drugs for. Like, for example, diabetic neuropathy. So what I was going after with my next kind of train of thought is that there are plenty of things where it's an either or. So if you've got asthma and the asthma drugs make your heart beat too fast and you don't want to take steroids because those make you hyper, there's definitely a place for treating asthma with acupuncture. And again, because that's an inflammatory disease, it makes sense to me to treat it that way. It's an internal inflammatory disease. It's a loop, just like your father's eye twitch. This is a loop that once things are looping and you kind of hit the reset button on the nervous system, anyone who's ever worked with a computer is aware that you can get into these loops where things just don't work. And then you're like, okay, let's just reboot. And then magically things work again. Or you close the program and then restart it. And so I think that's a big part of how it works, and it works really well with the nervous system. and the central nervous system in pain. And so I'm amazed. I want one quick story for myself.
Okay, caller, hold on. We see you. We'll be with you in just a second.
I am a ceramicist, and I burned myself on an 1,800-degree Fahrenheit, and it blistered up like crazy. I threw the needles around it immediately, did the points on my finger, and I watched the blister just disappear.
Isn't that something?
I just watched. I should have videoed it.
And let's take this call.
Yeah, let's do it.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
I was curious about hyperthyroid, if you've ever dealt with nodules that are overproducing thyroid hormone.
I have not personally treated hyperthyroidism with acupuncture, but I know that many acupuncturists that of my acquaintance, because, hey, we're in a town with an acupuncture college, do, in fact, treat that effectively. And so I would say that when people have hyperthyroidism, there's a couple reasons. They can have an autoimmune disease. Oh, that's an interesting sound. Do you have a dragon or a
somebody
alligator?
Gargling?
It sounds like an alligator, actually.
Yeah.
Motorcycle.
Okay, just curious. I like the alligator better. Anyway, so you can calm down all of the reactions. You can soothe the system. If it's an active nodule, a hyperactive nodule, that's a little bit easier to reboot than the autoimmune disease, which is where people actually make an antibody that stimulates the thyroid. It looks like thyroid-stimulating hormone, which is a fascinating disease called Graves' disease. But in any event, you can mellow out the symptoms, and I have seen those thyroid nodules shrink and respond. And I've seen papers in the acupuncture literature about that. So the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. And if you want to try that, my advice is calm down. If you're having rapid heartbeat, calm that down with a beta blocker, and then go start your acupuncture treatments. And but you don't want to let your heart run away with you. That could be a little risky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I realize that is one of the risks. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for your call. That leaves the line open at 459-4036. And we're working right now to get Dr. Don here more than once a month. And we don't know exactly how long it's going to take, but it will be soon. And she will be having a weekly show, is our hope.
Yeah, you know that program content committee that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah.
Maybe you could send them an email.
Yeah, send an email. Let's have Dr. Don at KZSC. Then you know you can stay.
Exactly. We'll run off the end of the hour.
Let's take this call. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi, I have bursitis in my hip. It's called trochanteric bursitis.
I know it well.
I had it diagnosed. And I wondered if acupuncture is good for that.
It is, and I've done acupuncture for trochanteric bursitis, and it is effective. I also strongly recommend a couple of other things. So I will say that I like synergy. I like to kind of pick and choose from what's available. So some kind of ice treatment and some kind of anti-inflammatory treatment. And I particularly like the combination of fish oil and curcumin. I don't like ibuprofen and naproxen for a couple of reasons, but they tear up your stomach something awful. And because I do functional medicine, you know, first you tear up your stomach, and then you start getting wheat sensitivity or some other food sensitivity because you've been, you've got this compound and your immune system thinks it's an invader because it's getting where it shouldn't be because you tore up your stomach. And so ibuprofen leads to a lot of food sensitivity, and then food sensitivity perpetuates inflammation. And then you get this thing like a bursitis that just won't go away and wants to keep creeping up on you. So the whole caboodle, the combination of those treatments is very, very powerful. And it's like, one person playing soccer versus a full bunch of people playing soccer makes a big difference in the quality of the game.
Could you talk a little bit about curcumin and what the best form of that is to take and how much?
And before we get away, I would like you to explain that medical term you used just a moment ago.
Inflammation?
No, caboodle.
Oh, caboodle. Ah, yes. Well, this is very obscure.
I knew I had
term.
A kit, but... I'm sorry, go ahead. Let's answer the question.
Okay, curcumin. All right. So curcumin is found in the spice turmeric. It's the act. We think it's the active anti-inflammatory ingredient. There's an enormous amount of biochemistry here. But you remember I was talking about that factor on the inside of the cell that gets the signal to become inflamed and goes into the nucleus and turns it on. That factor is called NF-kappa-B. And what curcumin does is it deactivates NF-kappa-B. So it keeps it from being activated and deactivates it once it started. So that means fewer molecules heading to fewer nuclei, turning on fewer ibuprofen, turning on fewer prostaglandins. And so it is it has the same mechanism of action as ibuprofen, but at a different place on the cascade, which is good because the way ibuprofen works, it actually blocks the good prostaglandins. And I won't get any deeper, I promise. But the good prostaglandins do things like make your stomach mucus. Oh, wait a minute. That was the thing, that's why the ibuprofen tears up your stomach, because it reduces your protective stomach mucus. So that's not a good trade-off. Curcumin, on the other hand, doesn't have any effect on stomach mucus, and because it's blocking things at a different point on the pathway. So it works with the body better. Now, it's expensive to get good, high-quality curcumin that's in a form that's going to be bioavailable. And the problem with a lot of natural agents is they aren't available. You put them in your mouth, they go into your stomach, but you only absorb 5% or 10%. In the case of turmeric, if it's good quality, fresh turmeric, you will get 10% of the in as curcumin, give or take, right? So you want that curcumin, so you can kick that up with pepper. So if you're not wanting to spend a lot of money on nutraceuticals, you get get a pepper grinder and you mix the turmeric, just the raw fresh turmeric, and black pepper, and it's about 10 to 1 on your ratio there. And then you put that in little capsules, and you can put that in capsules. And you'd need to take about a teaspoon worth of turmeric and pepper mixture once or twice a day to get enough curcumin to get that NF-kappa-B disabled, so to speak. And, of course, you have to keep doing it because you have to keep putting it in because you keep wanting to make more activators for the NF-kappa-B.
And, well, that's good to know about do-it-yourself. But if
you want to buy stuff, buy you want 500 to 750 milligrams.
I'm sorry, what was that again?
I said, 500 to 750 milligrams of curcumin.
If I buy it at the store.
If you buy it at the store, and there are better and worse products. So I look for something that is very yellow, and you want something that is kind of fatty or oily. Open the capsule, and it should be a little bit oily. Even if it's white, it should feel a little greasy because you need that fat to absorb it.
And so those would come in capsule form.
They do come in capsule form, and there's,
are they over the counter?
They are over the counter, and the brands that I like to use. I like Pure Encapsulations. That's a quality brand, and they've doctored it nicely. There's a product called CuraPro, CuraPro. That's the one I stock in my office. Thorne Pharmaceuticals has a product called Meriva, MERIVA, and those all work great. So if you're going to go with curcumin, that would be the strategy that I'd recommend.
CuraPro, and Thorne?
Is the Thorne company, it makes Meriva, MERIVA.
Okay.
And you want about 500 milligrams of those.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try this. And maybe I'll go get some acupuncture and see if that works.
Go on YouTube and look up trochanteric bursitis stretches. There's because you've got to stretch that tendon that goes from your knee to your hip. That's part of the problem here.
The IT band.
The IT band, yes.
Yeah.
And it's hard to stretch, but you can do it.
Hey, thanks for your call. Good questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I have a friend who's been treating himself a diet and using curcumin and pep pepper, black pepper.
Right, good. That's exactly right.
And it's just, he's living 10 years now since he was diagnosed with cancer. And it's all, and it is reduced and everything. He's almost there, you know, and 10 years of living after going, well, it's, you know, you're a short timer.
Well, you know, you never really know with cancer, but let me ask you a question. Did he change his lifestyle substantially after his diagnosis?
Yes.
Those are the cancer patients I always love to see and come into my office. I do a lot of cancer medicine, functional medicine support for cancer. And I use the acupuncture to help with chemo side effects. But the people who have kind of done or are doing the Western medical therapy are missing half the boat, because what makes a cancer, we now understand, is the cellular environment. And so if you drink a lot of coffee and you're full of stress and you don't eat right and you're mildly malnourished, you're just setting up territory where the cancer is just going to grow like weeds in a vacant lot. And the difference when you change your behavior and you start doing stress reduction and you start exercising and you start eating nutrients and taking these anti-inflammatories and getting rid of all the starch calories and sugar calories, and you clean up your act. When you clean up your act, you can watch the cancers back down. Dean Ornish, who I respect very much, about 30 years ago, he did a study showing that you could lower cholesterol and reverse heart disease, actually reverse it, get those plaques in the coronary arteries to shrink. And this was 30 years ago that he came up with this, and he showed, you know, you had these people who had horrible heart attacks, and you could measure how narrow their arteries were, and the arteries got better with just diet, exercise, and stress reduction. And so he's been pushing this for 30 years, and about 2008, he published a study where they took people with prostate cancer who were quote-unquote low risk and were doing watchful waiting, which means the doctors don't think the cancer is going to grow that fast. And they biopsied them at multiple intervals. They put them on this program. The people who participated in the program got a baseline biopsy, and then they looked at what cancer genes were turned on and how active they were. Which, it's amazing we can do that.
Really?
So they got a gene array, essentially, and then they biopsied them again a little while later and again a little while later, and you can watch these cells back away from being cancer cells and become less aggressive and less cancerous. And this is even visible on a microscopic slide. So the Gleason scores got better, but the DNA got better. And you generate your DNA. What DNA is turned on, that is to say, and what's being transcribed is a product of the environmental inputs. And your state of mind is an environmental input, but so is what you put in your mouth. And it's amazing stuff. So the thing that I hate is when a person, I love it when a person comes in and they have a crappy lifestyle, because I know I can help them with their cancer.
Right.
And it's like sometimes people come in and they have done all the right things. You know, they're like vegan and they exercise every day and they meditate and they, you know, take multivitamin, and they come in and they've got cancer, and I'm like, oh, I probably haven't got as much to work with in terms of lifestyle change for that individual. And I don't have, you know, I can help them, but I can't help them as much. Well, let's talk about a transformation in learning. This is research that's been done largely by the military. And I'm so intrigued with this. So direct current stimulation with a very, very low frequency on your head will actually improve your learning. And they used, it's called transcranial pulsed current stimulation. And you basically turn on the stimulus, then turn it off, turn it on, turn it off. And it's a fixed interval. They're doing something very similar with magnets, and that works as well. We also do something in acupuncture with needles, and we think that works too. We can certainly show increased blood flow when we put needles in the scalp. The part of the brain under the scalp, you know, a quarter inch of bone, lights up. And that's like, whoa, how's that happening? But there's obviously some kind of reflex arc. And when you increase blood flow to an area, you increase its activity because you've just given it a big dose of food. And so when you, what we're at right now is we're at a point where we're able to proved that we can do this because we can measure the effect. And now we're trying to figure out the code. And so right now that's just a doop on your head. And it's very low level current, but they've done studies where they apply this to head, and you can, for example, put it over the motor cortex for the hand, and the person will learn to play the piano faster. And you can do this, as I said, the same effect can be done with magnets, and there's a whole field now called transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Now, there was a chiropractor up in Ben Lomond, mm-hmm. who did that, and he would take, well, he also used crystals, but and magnets together to stimulate an area. And Betty,
yeah.
when we first got together, gave me a pass to go see this guy, and I was, when you think that, well, I'm going to put these rocks and magnets on you, you immediately go,
But remember, we're talking energy fields,
yeah.
and so it doesn't take a whole lot to budge an energy field. People do use magnets primarily, to my knowledge, on acupuncture points on the body, and I'll often use, and there are, of course, these mattresses and shoes that you can buy that have magnets in them that I'm skeptical about. I think we don't really know how to do this right. Magnets come in all ranges of Gauss, which is the index for measurement for their power. And there's going to be a right one. There's going to be a right strength. And there's of course, a positive and a negative pole. So I think that the commercial devices are probably not as good as a practitioner who actually has a technique. And so I'm all for people doing that. It's non-invasive, and your client is going to decide whether it works. I mean, they're paying you good money. If they don't feel better after a certain number of treatments, they're probably going to go look elsewhere.
Yeah.
And that's that's free market, right? They're always saying, "Oh, free market." Well, it's like, okay, this is free market, and people can decide if it's working for them. But I love it when the science bears it out. So this one, the brain stimulation, this is really just a little spark gap generator. You could, and this is so, would be so easy to hook up to a 9-volt battery and basically create your own brain stimulator. And people could look at the paper, and this was published in PLOS1, which is the Journal of Public Library of Public Library of Science. And we have a problem in medicine with our literature in that it's being bought up and sequestered, and PLOS is a great journal.
What do you mean sequestered?
I mean it costs me $35 to get a paper, and I can't afford every paper I want to look at to pay $35. And it's a real problem.
Why is it so much?
Because they want
money.
Money, because they want to make money, and they want to encourage people to pay for the institutional license. An institutional license costs thousands of dollars a year. So ultimately, it's about trying to defray the costs of publishing the research. And the internet has created this sort of immediate access to research. It's a problem. We could talk about that some other time.
Okay.
I wanted to give out the. I wanted to just say that if you want to look at this, this is in the 2015 PLOS1. It's volume 10, number 7. And if you just search transcranial pulsed current stimulation, you will find it. And I think you could probably get a recipe and try this at home. You know, they used to say, kids, don't try this at home. Well, I'm just saying, kids, try this at home, but follow their protocol. Don't just mess around.
Yeah.
The military has helmets that use magnetic stimulation. And I read a fascinating article by a reporter who went to a shooting range and was wearing one of these helmets. And this person already knew how to target shoot, but wasn't that good. Wearing the helmet, they hit the center every time. So it amplified their ability to fix a target. And motor skills is one of those things we can readily test and classify and identify. It probably works for it works for memory too, but it's harder to measure memory, and we have more blunt tools, whereas our ability to measure measure motion is really very good. So I thought people might be interested in improving their brain function. I wanted to take a few moments and talk about Zika virus and kind of you know, first of all, some safety tips and also just a little a spin on it that I haven't heard in the news media. And that has to do with my enormous admiration for the scientific process and for how really great we are at figuring things out now. And Zika is in the stage of, let's start with, this is a virus that has recently emerged on the scene and has probably mutated because it's been around since the 50s. We've known about it. But this connection with the microcephaly is brand new. And most people suspect that this is a new mutation of Zika that has this property of its extreme neurotropic ability to go into a developing fetus and mess with brain development. I had talked earlier about those signals that create inflammation, but when you talk about development from a single fertilized egg to a human baby, you're talking about a symphony of signals that goes on for 9 months, and any disruption in that is like during the quiet part during an orchestra, you know, somebody blatting out with a horn, and it just throws everything off. And we have seen birth defects from drugs before, like, for example, the famous thalidomide, which interfered with the development signal for make an arm, make a leg, and the babies were born effectively with flippers. And what happens is make a brain gets disrupted. And so the babies are born with very small skulls and very small brains. And that's bad enough. It took a while to figure out. But let's stay tuned, because this is going to be over the next few years. If you'd have to put an RSS feed or something and read the literature. The news are going to drop this and not follow the science. But the science of figuring this out is going to be fascinating. And I want to see those tools brought to bear and watch as we come to understand how this works, because it's going to teach us so much about embryology and about development. Back to the safety tips. This is a virus that causes symptoms in 10% of the people who get it, and we have global warming. So it's only a matter of time before this virus starts showing up in the United States. Right now we've got, last I heard, which was 2 days ago, there were 50 cases in Puerto Rico and 10 documented cases in Florida. And the ones in Florida were all worked in the same two restaurants or had been to the same two restaurants.
Isn't that fascinating?
So we're talking like one mosquito, more than likely, or maybe two.
Do they bite multiple times?
I thought that mosquitoes only took one blood meal, but I don't know that fact for the Aedes aegyptes. And so I thought, that's for malaria, and that's Anopheles. And so I'm not an entomologist, so I'm not actually, is it? Yes, entomology, right, for bugs. And the scary thing is that it does seem to not take a lot to pass through a population, and that's what they're seeing in the clusters in Brazil. And now we've got all these Olympians who are heading to Brazil and will be coming back from Brazil. And if you're a male Olympian, the current advice is really scary. 6 months. Don't make anybody pregnant for 6 months. We've cultured it out of sperm 6 months after documented infection.
And it lands in the sperm. That's just such an interesting thing.
It's not that it lands in the sperm. I thought about this when that first came out, and I said, oh, of course, duh. It gets into the sperm as they're being formed, and it goes into the bloodstream, all right? And the sperm are in contact with the bloodstream enough when they're being formed and created, and they're constantly being created, that's when it gets the infection. And it catches the Zika, but then the sperm is stored for 3 to 6 months in the tubules. So after you do a vasectomy, you have to be sure you tell the guy, okay, you've got 3 months worth of sperm. And so don't lose the condom yet. The idea that a man has to refrain from impregnating anyone for 6 months raises all kinds of issues around contraception and various other things. Obviously, if a person is exposed to Zika and has no symptoms, then it's kind of a nightmare because you just don't know what you can do. And we can't find it in the blood of these men. That's the really important thing. So if a man went to, let's say they went to Central America 3 months ago, and they didn't get sick, and they didn't get tested. So we can check for antibodies. And we don't really know if everybody shows antibodies, but if you're, let's suppose you're antibody positive after your trip to Costa Rica, you're basically, it's 6 months before you could impregnate anyone if you're seeking pregnancy. And here's the really spooky part, blood donation.
Oh, God.
Oh, God.
That didn't enter my
that
mind at all.
Yes, yes. So
you can't give blood. That's a,
well, if you've, it, basically, I think what's going to happen is it's in the United States now. Okay, so are we going to tell everybody in Florida you can't give blood, or everybody in Puerto Rico? I mean, what's Puerto Rico going to do for a blood supply?
Well, don't you, can you, you can test if it's in there, can't you?
You can test if there's antibody. There's a 2 week, around a 2 week lag before you start forming antibody, during which you have virus in your system but no symptoms, and how would we know to test you?
Boy.
And so what we need is a rapid test. They'll do that. That'll be one of the first things they do. So we'll have a rapid test for Zika that will be done at every blood bank, and they'll take a history, and, you know, we'll probably stop up that one, but it's going to create a strain on the blood supply. And when it's in the United States, what kind of travel history are you looking for? And remember, as the mosquitoes, this Aedes aegypti mosquito is heading north, and we're seeing things like chikungunya and dengue, which are the two other viruses that are transmitted by this agent, this vector. We're seeing them move north into the United States, into the Texas Panhandle, into a whole bunch of other places. So climate change is driving this evolution of disease. And that's an interesting story all by itself. And and as I said, we don't actually know what is going to happen. What I wanted to do was just give out the warnings, what the CDC yeah. says for women. So women who are asymptomatic, who want to conceive, who have been anywhere where there might be Zika, which is basically anywhere you, it will soon be all of the southern states, have to wait 8 weeks before they get pregnant. Now, what if you live in that state? You're kind of up the creek. We don't know a lot. We don't know how likely you are to get it if you're exposed. We don't know how it will affect the pregnancy. We don't know how likely it is it'll pass to the fetus. And we don't know, there's so much we don't know about this. And it's going to be a very interesting story as it evolves. If you tune in and listen to me, I will keep you posted. But for right now, the recommendations are, for the man, it's 6 months, wear a condom for 6 months. For the woman, it's 8 weeks. And you can get a blood test for antibodies if you're 2 weeks after your potential exposure. That's the take home.
Okay. So, I had a strange experience this last week. I went on a hike, and this happens to me, and this is up the coast here. And I came home, but that day I'd had 32 ticks on me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people that went with us had none, another guy had five. But every time that this happens, I have multiple ticks more than anybody else. Any ideas on why I would pick up more ticks than anybody else?
Well, my top hypothesis is you're putting out more CO2. And I'm not sure. I know mosquitoes, that's one of the things that they home in on is CO2.
Yeah.
So if you want to create a mosquito trap, you put out CO2 and they'll hone in on it. And, of course, that's what we breathe out. So that's a possibility. Another possibility might be a smell or a pheromone. A particular compound that comes out of your pores when you sweat, because uh-huh. you mentioned that you're hiking, so you're probably, you know, losing some material. And that might be something that you just make more of. People can have really wide variations in how much of things they make due to changes in their genetics. Something called copy number variation comes to mind. You might just have an enzyme that makes a pheromone that is 100 times more powerful than everybody else's. So you're making 100 times more of the stuff, and this just happens to be the stuff.
Yeah, that they like.
The putative substance that they home in on. And I don't know enough, again, I don't know enough entomology to tell you what the ticks home in on, but they home in on something warm-blooded mammals produce.
Yeah, I heard heat is part of what they
Are you just a hot guy?
I am. I wanted to get that out. Thanks for asking.
It's always better if someone throws you a softball.
A softball, thanks. anyway, that thank you for the answer there, because my friends are always going, how, but they make me walk first now, so I'll get all the ticks out of the way and they won't get on them.
Oh, wow, that's mean.
And I'm not creeped out by ticks like a lot of people. Just the first thing they see one crawling on them, they scream. And if you're calm and collected, they come right off. They're hard to kill. They have the toughest exoskeleton. I don't know what it is, but you have to get it right between your fingernails.
Oh, yeah. You need a fingernail edge.
Yeah. And you just pull them off. And if they get it takes them a while before they settle in.
You might be able to electrocute them with a 9-volt battery. Another DIY project.
Well, I thought he'd get little pins, and mm-hmm. I could stick them with the pins.
There you go. You could have a collection.
Yes. In fact, once in Tennessee, I walked into this store, and they had a collection of local ticks, and there was like 30 ticks up in this little thing. Ew. Well, anyway, ticks are another whole subject, and we're going to have time to do that again next month. Once more, I'd like to get your website and how people can get in touch with you.
Okay, so it's optimagehealth.com, OPT, image and then health, all in a row.
And your office is located on Mission Street.
At Mission Street.
And spell Motika for them.
Motyka. And I'll just tell you, if you're interested and would like more of this sort of talk, there is a podcast, AskDrDawn.com, and I also speak in a couple of other venues right now. And I pull those all together and put them up as podcasts. And there's a huge archive of previous podcasts. So everyone's welcome to take a look at that.
So they can hear this show. Well, and we'll have you back next month. We don't know the date yet, but I'll announce it. And
I'll announce it at AskDrDawn.com, too.
All right. Such a pleasure to have you here. I'm so glad you've ended up spending some of your time with us now.
It's been very enjoyable. I love talking to you and talking about science. So thank you so very much.
We'll do it again.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. Or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. We have new projects in the works, and I have good news. It looks like we'll probably be back on the air as of the first Saturday in July. Watch the website for more news about that. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.